I'm Jeff Sickinga, Executive Director of the Ashbrook Center, and this is The American Idea, where we discuss the ideas, people, and events that have made America what it is today. We believe that by understanding our history and our principles, we can better live up to the promise of the American founding and preserve our ongoing experiment in self-government. Welcome to The American Idea.
Well, I want to welcome everyone to this episode of The American Idea. Today, we're going to be talking about one of the two major political parties in the United States, shifts that are happening in the Democratic Party, what the data show, what that means for us, for our understanding of American public life, and perhaps its connection to past episodes in American history. Joined for that conversation by J.T. Young. Many of you may read JT's work. He is a widely published author. He has published, his work has appeared in places like the Wall Street Journal, Real Clear Politics, and The Hill. And in fact, he's an opinion contributor for The Hill. Previous to that, he has worked for United States Congress, the Department of Treasury, and the Office of Management and Budget. His education, he has a bachelor's degree from the University of Chicago, a PhD from Cornell University in American politics. So we have with us someone who spent a long time thinking about these kinds of political issues. J.T. Young, welcome to The American Idea.
Thank you so much, Jeff. It's a pleasure to be with you today.
As our listeners know, in other episodes, we have talked about shifts in the Republican Party, both contemporary and historic shifts in the Republican Party and its voters and its coalitions. Today, we're talking about the Democratic Party, and you have written recently about shifts that are happening in the Democratic Party, some of which seem to be unexpected by a lot of political observers. Maybe we should just start with the data. What do the data show about shifts that are happening right now in the Democratic Party?
Well, one thing that's really interesting, Jeff, about what you're talking about is, in my latest book, I do a historical look at the Democrat Party. And, you know, one of the things that we tend to forget, especially conservatives, is that there historically was a real conservative element to the Democrat Party and a moderate element until very recently. And if you look at so much of the polling data, and Gallup has a really good one, and they do this over a timeline, that basically in the last generation or 30 years, the Democrat Party's liberal base has more than doubled. It's gone from about a quarter of what it used to be in the Democrat Party not that long ago. And when you think back about 30 years, we're talking about in the Clinton administration, it's now 54%. So that's a huge shift. And it's particularly dangerous for Democrats, I think, because when you pull the liberal party or the liberal group, it's the smallest ideological base in American politics. I just did a column very recently where I was looking at this and looked at exit polling from 2024. And those who self-identified as liberal versus moderate and conservative, liberals who self-identified were only about 23% of the electorate. So you can see the danger here, which is you're making a majority of your party from a minority ideological segment of American society. And I think what we're seeing, and you're seeing this so much now, that not only were Democrats resoundingly rejected at the polls last November, and they really were, if you look inside the votes, and we can talk about that more, but not only were they rejected last November, but since then, in a lot of cases, you see them actually almost doubling down on some of the positions that I think clearly cost them last November. And the reason, again, is, which seems, it seems a lot to us like it's illogical behavior, because you're actually going in the wrong direction. But again, if you take back and step back and look at what we saw in the Democrat Party when 54% of your base is liberal, you really don't have a choice. That's your base. And so you were mentioning in other shows where you've talked about the Republican Party. And I think we've seen it very, very clearly in the Republican Party, where very conservative elements were turning on less conservative members or more moderate members in the fear of primary challenges. You're now seeing that very clearly in the Democrat Party. And one very clear episode of this is what happened on the last funding bill, you know, what we call the CR, continuing resolution to keep government funding. And this legislation took the government through the end of the fiscal year, which is the end of September of this year. So you saw the outrage that came from the left when Senator Schumer, who's the minority leader in the Senate, and nine other Democrats or people who vote with the Democrats voted for the Republican spending bill. And one of the most prominent people who was a critic of this was AOC. Well, you also see AOC now being mentioned as a primary challenge to Senator Schumer. And Senator Schumer is nothing but a very liberal, very, very liberal member of the Senate. However, he's not AOC. And suddenly you're now seeing this dynamic, or at least being threatened to play out, that AOC is being pushed as a potential primary challenger to Schumer when he runs in 2028. So you're seeing that kind of internal conflict really starting to shape out or shake out. And you see and had seen somewhat the same thing happening. If you've been looking inside baseball, Nancy Pelosi, the former speaker from San Francisco in Congress for over four decades, has been challenged by a former AOC staff member in the next in the upcoming Democrat primary in San Francisco. So again, someone from the far left challenging someone who's just on the left. And I think both of these cases demonstrate what we're seeing within the Democrat Party. There are clear fissures happening.
So that's interesting to me. I wonder if, thinking about this, if the Democratic Party, as you're saying, the base has moved to the left. Is that the natural process of political parties sorting themselves out ideologically rather than geographically? So, for example, you used to think about the Democrats would be the party of the South, right? So there was a geography, or the West, the South and West, and Republicans. And clearly, over time, new geographies have developed where Republicans are strong in certain parts of the country, Democrats are in others. But it seems to be that's because those geographies are more in line with their ideological principles, not because it's geographic. Are we seeing a natural ideological sorting of the parties, or is something else going on?
No, I think some of it is natural. I think for the Democrats in this case, it's very unfortunate. Again, you're picking your majority out of the minority ideological group, which strategically is a dangerous place to be. If you look, moderates in the last election were 40 or so percent of voters. I think conservatives were about 37, 38%. Those are just rough estimates. But you get the drift, which is if you are the Democrats and you're pulling your majority from 23% of the voters, that means 77% of the voters are not the leaders in your base. And I think to take it another step, the Democrats, while 54% are liberal, that also means 46% are not. They need that 46% desperately in order to maintain their, you know, political and electoral standing. They need those votes as legacy votes. And you're now finding, I think, such extreme positions that you are in danger of eroding your base further. That, in other words, that there are going to be Democrat members that are just not comfortable. Look at two primary people who did not return in the last Congress for the Democrats, Kristen Sinema from Arizona and Joe Manchin from West Virginia. You know, when Joe Manchin retired, his seat was already lost. West Virginia is now so red, there was no chance the Democrats would hold that seat. Manchin was the only person who had a fighting chance. You look at Kristen Sinema, was a leading moderate and one of the people who was a pivotal member in the last Congress. Both are gone. It's not a surprise when you're seeing more and more moderates. Look at the members who've already said they're not going to run for re-election for the Democrats already in the Senate. Gary Peters, establishment Democrat, middle of the road within his party, not running in Michigan, a dangerous area for Democrats because they lost the state to Trump in November. The senator from Minnesota, who's not going to run. The senator from New Hampshire, who's not going to run. They're moderate Democrats within the Democrat Party. That's where you're seeing the atrophication. And I think to your point, we are seeing parties that are becoming less geographically centered as they used to be. And more ideologically centered, because you have, just such a larger marketplace of ideas. I mean, you think back, and you were mentioning, I think, where the Democrat Party used to be the party of the South. No part of the country was a bigger supporter of FDR or a more important coalition of the New Deal coalition member of the New Deal coalition than the South. Completely gone. And, FDR was assiduous in keeping the South on his side. And that was so important. But back in those days, when you think about it, there was limited national news. News was local, it came from your local paper. So you moved more likely in geographic blocks. It still manifests itself in geographic blocks. But I think to your point, it's more ideologically centered, and the geographic is secondary. So, in other words, yes, Massachusetts is solidly Democrat, but it's solidly Democrat because it's solidly liberal, more than because it's from the Northeast, which is, some historical carryover for the Democrats.
So if I can pursue that line a little bit more, but it's really interesting to me that not that long ago, maybe 10, maybe 20 years ago, think of President Obama's administration, 15 years ago, people were writing, the emerging Democratic majority.
Right.
There was going to be a permanent Democratic majority. Teixeira and other folks were writing that. And now, of course, some of those same folks are rethinking this very critically. What happened to that emerging, potentially permanent or multi-generational Democratic majority?
Well, you make a very good point. In my book, Unprecedented Assault, I mentioned the Obama administration. I think it was a very pivotal one because I think Obama basically rehabilitated the traditional left in national presidential politics. If you go back to basically 1968, so for about 50 years prior, at the national presidential level, being a liberal was absolutely a liability. They ran from the label. I think Obama, obviously a very charismatic man, great public speaker, always seemingly unflappable, very much rehabilitated what I call the traditional left in presidential politics. And as you were saying, at that time, I think people were thinking, oh, this is now an unbeatable coalition. That demographics, because they imagined that demographics was destiny, which I think is absolutely wrong. And I think we see this And it's played out if we look at in regards to age groups. Generally, if you look again at exit polling, look at your voters in the youngest to the oldest categories. Voters usually get more conservative as they get older. Life experiences, whatever you want to say. I think there was a misperception that people were somehow, naturally more conservative at one point, and then conservatives were aging out, and they were discounting the fact that people actually get more conservative as they move up the socioeconomic scale, as they move across the chronological age scale, that these things actually are more dynamic than people gave them credit for. And you see this so much within different voter blocks where people were astounded that Trump was winning many more in the black community than he had gotten before, many more in the Hispanic community that they thought was untouchable. That he did so well with younger voters. And I know there was a recent polling, and I wrote an article about it, about Generation Z voters being more conservative than prior generations. And they don't mean that they're more conservative now than older generations are, but what they're saying is they're more conservative at this point in their lives. And I think this goes to your question, which is if they're this conservative now and they get more conservative as they grow older, that this could be a real danger going forward for Democrats because they've already lost people, and how are they going to regain them? And I know in the article that I'm mentioning, I cited that a lot of the things that have gone wrong in the country recently, you think about the COVID lockdowns, things like that, they affected the Generation Z people more than any other age group. I mean, we all suffered from lockdowns, but only Generation Z was locked out of their schools. So, things like that that have made them, I believe, more conservative and then threatened to age them even more conservative as they grow older.
So obviously, these trends have been noticed. The outcome of the last presidential election and congressional elections have been noticed inside the Democratic Party. And you have written, as others have, about the arguments that are taking place right now in the Democratic Party over the direction of the party and the issues that you've cited. What are those debates inside the Democratic Party right now?
Well, I think you see the fissures within the Democrat Party basically on every conceivable one. You see it on gender, you see it on age. I had mentioned earlier about the former AOC staffer taking on Nancy Pelosi in her district. And if you read that young man's, statement as to the mission statement of his candidacy, he prominently notes that Senator Nancy Pelosi, Speaker Pelosi, has been in Congress for over 40 years. Obviously, there's a code word there that she's of a older generation. He's also makes mention of the fact that that the new, more left people need to step in now, and certainly you see that in regards to AOC, whose own term in Congress began by knocking out Joe Crowley, who was, an establishment Democrat from way back, cut out of the whole, the cloth of the typical big city Democrat, had a future that everyone thought in the Democrat leadership in the House going forward. So you see it as generational, you see it as ideological. I think you see it as gender. I think you see it on economics as well, as to how redistributive do you want policies to be? There is a segment within the Democrat Party that wants these to be to be greatly redistributive. But if you think about it, there are also establishment Democrats who are going to feel threatened by that. There are going to be different groups, voter blocs within the Democrat Party. We've already mentioned Hispanics. We've mentioned blacks. You can mention other groups. Well, the more you focus on one group, inherently you are then tacitly not focusing on another. How many of those groups feel left out? And there are obviously members of the Democrat historical base that I think feel directly challenged, and that would certainly be the Jewish community, which has historically been very strongly Democrat. And now suddenly, especially in the wake of the Hamas terrorist attack in Israel and the reaction that they're seeing in America, but particularly on American college campuses, feeling themselves being targeted by people who are claiming to be speaking for Democrats or of the left. And they feel themselves, and I think very rightfully so, threatened by that. So you see all of these cleavages kind of playing out simultaneously within the Democrat Party.
Before we continue with our conversation, I'd like to take a moment and ask you to learn a little more about the Ashbrook Center and how you can help us continue our work with teachers, students, and citizens.
I'm Chad Kiefer, Director of Philanthropy and Strategic Partnerships here at Ashbrook. At its heart, America's story is about the lives of patriots who have given their last full measure of devotion to preserve and protect what it means to be an American. But the tragic truth is that the American story is being rewritten as one of oppression and despair. Back in 1776, the founders took a chance when they created a new government built on principles of liberty. They took a chance on America. Now I'm challenging you to do the same. Your gift to Ashbrook today reaches students, teachers, and citizens across the country, helping them to understand why America is worthy of their devotion. With so many forces eroding our history and taking away from our principles, isn't it time we give America a chance? Your investment is encouraged now more than ever. Please visit us today at ashbrook.org/support.
It also seems to me, and along those same lines, as you mentioned, the cleavages on economics. I mean, I was struck by, and a lot of Democrats were struck by, I think it was Bernie Sanders' comment, text, tweet, whatever it was. It says, is it a surprise? Are we Democrats surprised? Or are the Democrats surprised that the working class abandoned us when we've abandoned them?
Right.
What about this argument inside the Democratic Party about economic populism versus sort of coastal elites?
Right. And I think, we've all had the image in our mind of what was called the limousine liberal, the person who drove up to the protest, got out of the limousine, held a sign for a few minutes, got back in and went back to the affluent neighborhood from whence they came. I think that just what you mentioned is, of course, a danger for the Democrat Party. And again, you look back and see the split that we had mentioned earlier with between liberals and just non-liberals within the party. If 54% are liberal, then that means 46% are not. And Democrats are roughly 35% of the electorate. So without going into a whole lot of math, it's very clear that a little less than half your membership is not that liberal. And so that could be that they are, as Bernie Sanders would say, working class, but with different sets of, of values. Do they have a more traditional and conservative social values? Are they people who they just want to make it within the current system and see themselves then threatened by people who are saying, no, we want to tear the system down? All of these are important groups within Democrats that they need to keep. And this is always difficult, I think, for any political party. But at a time of such upheaval within Democrats, from what they have just encountered, and then the pressures that they're now feeling from a very aggressive Trump administration that's pursuing executive actions. I think a lot of them feel themselves being thrown back and in disarray as to how do we respond. And as you're searching for a way to respond, you find yourself picking over these cleavages that are there and that exist for any party, but under a period of stress become accentuated, just as almost you can think of it in a geological analogy of tectonic plates. You know, we know the plates are there. We know there are points of contact. And for the most part, they can sit quietly. But then in a period of pressure, as we see, it erupts, as literally can erupt as a volcano, an earthquake, a tsunami. And it's all those pressures that are building up underneath, under the surface. And you're seeing the same thing, I think, right now within the Democrat Party.
You know, some people, as you know, historians and political scientists have talked about realigning elections. They point to elections, historic elections like the election of 1800, which seemed to destroy the Federalist Party, realign the country politically, 1860, the Republican Party, 1932, Franklin Roosevelt and the Democratic Party. Some people have said 2024 was a realigning election, and some people have said, no, it wasn't, or it's too soon. We have to see what happens with the Democratic Party. What's your view on that?
I think it's a great question, and it's one that I have I've been thinking about myself. And my sense would be, I'll wait and see. You know, realignment elections aren't necessarily apparent in the moment they happen. Even 1932, when you think about it and you think of the pressures, you had the depression that had just had not just occurred, but it was 4 years old. Essentially, it happened in 29. And by 32, people had were in their fourth year of it. And you had this huge change in the electorate. And I think you look back and you think, well, it's not that surprising. And the question then was going to be, will it hold? You know, when the pressure's removed, does it stay? And obviously, Franklin Roosevelt and the New Deal coalition was amazingly successful at maintaining what had been a cataclysmic election and then creating a coalition. I think the question now, you leap forward to the current day and ask yourself, is what Trump did in 2024, is that something that holds beyond him? Because I think realigning elections, in a, as you've raised, I think that they are more to the party, not to the person. People come and go. FDR served, he won four terms. He didn't serve all four, but he won four terms, unprecedented in American history. But the New Deal coalition extended well beyond him. And I think you could argue into roughly 1968 with Nixon's victories in the South, pulling the South away. So going back to the current scenario where, you know, in this last November election, we had seven what were considered seven swing states. And in 2016, Trump won six of them. In 2020, Biden won six of them. In 2024, Trump swept all seven. So the question is just looking at those three states, and that's really kind of what we talk about. You know, again, we talk in an analogy to tectonic plates. The pressure only shows up at the fringes, at the points of contact, and swing states are inherently that. So the question is going to be in 2028, whoever the Republicans nominate, can they hold those seven swing states? Can they start to make inroads into the second tier states that shouldn't be overlooked as getting relatively close, New Jersey, New Hampshire, Maine, Virginia, Minnesota, New Mexico, we're all within 10 percentage points. Do you continue to see another Republican making inroads into those, as well as holding these swing states that they want? If you start to see that, and it starts to go beyond just Trump, and we cannot discount, what a unique force in American politics Donald Trump has been. I mentioned FDR. We all know he won four terms. Trump's the first person since FDR to win three consecutive major party nominations in a row. That puts him in an elite company. It just doesn't happen. And it has with him. So the real question has to be, does what we see right now in the Republican Party go beyond Donald Trump? In some regards, you could actually make the argument, I think, that the conservative populism that Trump innately has touched and realized was there could actually be stronger than Donald Trump. And I would think that should be one of Democrats' biggest fears, which is Donald Trump is a polarizing figure. I read the polls every day. I'm sure you do the same thing. He's roughly a 50-50 person. He's got high favorability among the people who like him and low favorability among the people who don't. So he's basically always going to be at about 50-50. And the real concern, I think, for Democrats has to be, do Republicans come up with another nominee who can continue to tap in to conservative populism, but without some of the personal baggage that Donald Trump brings? If you do, then going back to your question about realignment, a person like that can hold those seven swing states. They could also make real inroads into those second tier states I was mentioning. And you start to do that, and you really start to put an electoral headlock on the presidency for Republicans. So I think that's a huge concern for Democrats going forward.
Interesting. And what about on the Democratic side? What are the prospects for the Democrats, given the current situation and their response to it, for putting back together what you call the New Deal coalition?
Well, certainly the New Deal coalition, when you think about, and we had mentioned early in this conversation, no place was more solid for the New Deal coalition than the South. The South is gone. I mean, Democrats can write that one off, with the exception of perhaps states that are growing in population and are attracting new people. And the two I'm thinking of are North Carolina and Georgia. Those were two of your swing states from the last time. And Trump still did held those without that much difficulty. So outside of those two states, the Democrats don't have a foreseeable future in the South and that part of the New Deal coalition. I think what they have to do, and they really have to be concerned about this, is where do you put your electoral votes so that you can win the presidency? And if you look outside of California and New York, Democrats run up huge majorities in two very populous states that do them no good whatsoever outside of the Electoral College. So, in other words, if you look at Biden, he won in 2020, I think about 4 million extra votes that came from California and New York. It does him no good anywhere else. But when you look at national polling and you see, oh, the Democrats are actually pretty close, because in national polling, which covers everything equally or should be, you're capturing that surplus in your national polling. But it's not helping you in the Electoral College, which is everything. So I know I had done a piece where I had subtracted out the votes from California, New York, Massachusetts, and Washington. So four states. outside of those four states lie 80% of your electoral votes. And Trump won something like 53 plus percent in those other 46 states. So your question as a Democrat is going to be, where do I get the votes I need to win the presidency? And you have to go back and look at those swing states, obviously, and look to recapturing, some of those. But basically, Democrats have to think of how do I forge myself an electoral college path to a majority and not see attrition within those second tier states, which are those are should be real concerns. I mean, I think, we'll have a governor's race in New Jersey coming up, and I would be very cautious if I'm Democrats as to how does that play out? Is there a chance we lose New Jersey? When you start losing anything more than they did, because as I recall, and I'll get the exact number wrong, but Trump won over 300 electoral votes. So, it's not overwhelming. You don't have to flip that many. But if you start to lose on any additional states, even small states like a New Hampshire, the question becomes, where do you make up the votes? And I remember right before the election in November, and I was doing this, it was for a British news show, and we were talking about, how November's outcome would be. And you could already see, which was all the contest was being played on the Democrat field. In other words, all the swing states were Democrat states, and everywhere that they could possibly l lose were these swing states, and there were no paths for them to make up those votes. When you had lost those seven states, there were no close Republican states that they could flip. There was no, they weren't going to flip Texas. They weren't going to flip Arkansas. And the question then becomes one of simple math, which is, where do I make up my deficit? So to your point, for the Democrats and redoing the New Deal coalition, they have to ask themselves, how do I make inroads into those other 46 states where I got beat pretty solidly?
Well, in the past, when the Democratic Party has faced this kind of difficulty at the presidential level, I'm thinking, for example, after Richard Nixon and Gerald Ford, and the Democrats want to take back the White House, they look for somebody who they look for someone who can help them in the South and who is moderate enough to appeal to the broad part of the country, but has good Democratic bona fides, and they settle on Jimmy Carter, who, of course, in 1976 wins election. I think a lot of people out there now are thinking, looking at a historical analogy like that to the current time, is there a figure in the Democratic Party that people are starting to look towards to say, okay, this person could be the person going forward around whom the party could rally?
It's a great question, and I think you could have added to it because Carter is certainly a quintessential example, no question. And he was, a huge outsider. After Watergate, it was exactly what the country wanted. They were fed up with Washington politics, and so they elect someone who was had graduated from the Naval Academy and was a peanut farmer from Georgia who had served as governor. And to your point, he could leverage votes within the South. I think the same thing happened then 16 years, or I'll do my math and get it wrong, but when Bill Clinton did the same thing from Arkansas, which was Bill Clinton was very comfortable from a conservative state working across the aisle. He worked with conservatives. He got it. He had an innate understanding, was truly a generational politician with just incredible antenna and instincts. So going back to your question, which would be, and again, in my book, Unprecedented Assault, I make mention of the same thing, which was, that the Democrat Party of 1976, the Democrat Party of 1992 is not that Democrat Party now. And then we go back to how we started in this conversation. In the early 90s, the mid 90s, the Democrat Party was 27% liberal, which meant they had large amounts of moderate and conservative Democrats that could nominate a Jimmy Carter, who could nominate a Bill Clinton, and it was not a stretch for the party to do so. Now, looking at someone like that, I don't see how a Democrat Party would nominate a Jimmy Carter or a Bill Clinton. And I would go so far as to say, I'm not convinced that they would nominate a Barack Obama anymore. This party is much, much further to the left than its predecessors have been when they were faced with this kind of a watershed event that you've just mentioned. How do we nominate somebody who can make inroads into the broader electorate that's not our core liberal base anymore? And I'm not sure I see that. We can name politicians who would fit the bill. Kentucky's former governor was successful, a Democrat in a very red state, and he was successful there. And I think we could probably pick up another couple of names like that. But then the question is, how does that person run in a Democrat primary from pillar to post, going through all the different states, and win the delegates that are necessary to secure the nomination? And I just don't see that anymore.
Well, that is a fascinating question, a thought-provoking one, and I think a great way for us to end this conversation and think, give us something to think about for the future, and a really, really important issue. What a fascinating conversation about the contemporary state and the historical analogies that the Democratic Party has faced then and is facing now, and as you suggest, will be facing in the future. J.T. Young, thanks for taking the time to join us today on The American Idea.
Thank you so much, Jeff. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you for listening to this episode of The American Idea. If you enjoyed this episode, remember to subscribe at Apple Podcast, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts, and leave a 5-star review. If you want to learn more or get involved in Ashbrook's vital work, visit our website, ashbrook.org.